Let me start. Okay, so this is hopefully working and will not disappear into some computer heaven of the Lama Ba. So this is our third shiur in the topic of fundamental feuds, the role of debate in Jewish life. And we started by a class just that discussed the benefit of debate and the benefit of machloket and how Judaism thinks of debate in the right context as something holy. Right, we have the expression of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. Both these and these can be the words of a living God. And we live in the paradox of differing opinions, both being divine, or all being divine. And that was the first class. And then we focused on the most important school of debate in Jewish thought, which is the machlokot, the debates between Hillel and Shammai, and then their students, Beit Hillel u Beit Shammai. And that was primarily a debate in halacha. And today, I think, today I'd like to explore something that is just as fundamental to our tradition and something that I had no idea existed until about 5 years ago. And I would suspect that this is a far lesser known debate, machloka, that exists within our tradition. So this is not primarily tonight about a debate in how to pasken halacha, how to decide Jewish law. Hey, Mimi, great to see you. This is a different kind of machloka, a different kind of debate. Well, you guys, welcome. Do we have enough source sheets?
Yeah.
Here's your usher. Hey, guys, come on in. Squeeze in. This is... squeeze in. Okay. Awesome. So, that's all. Thanks, Chester. So, welcome, guys. Just because we're on the official recorder of wherever this is going to end up on YU Torah. Last time we focused really on the debates of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, which are primarily debates about how to decide Jewish law. And we saw that Hillel, generally speaking, took a much more people-centered approach, which often Hillel's people-first approach led to both being more lenient and a combination of treating people with even more dignity than Beit Shammai, and that doesn't hurt to be on the more lenient side, generally won Beit Hillel, the house of Hillel, more fans and more students. And because they had the more students, and Jewish law is decided based on majority rules, when it came to the debates of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, almost without exception, I think there were 18 exceptions in the whole Talmud, Beit Hillel is the way that we follow, we pasken, we follow the law according to Beit Hillel in opposition to Beit Shammai, with just a few examples. Today, we're going to go into a different school or different schools of thought. But this is not primarily about halachic decision making. This is actually primarily about interpretation, how to interpret the words of the Torah. If you think about exegetics, you might even think about this in terms of, let's say, how to read the... there are different interpretive methods, just in terms of constitutional law, right? So I'm not American. I assume that I know far less about the Constitution than I think everyone else around the table.
You probably know as much.
Yeah. Okay.
From Mexico.
Okay. So maybe and I are off on the side, and it's everyone else who knows more about it than I do. But my understanding is that there's kind of a fundamental debate about how to read the Constitution, right? Do you read the Constitution according to the simple language, or do you try to get into the minds of the framers of the Constitution? Right, and I believe those are two schools of interpretation. Right? We also have schools of interpretation of how to read the Torah. And I never knew that until I found a book in the YU library. YU has one of the best Judaica collections in the world. And it was a book published, so YU's in Upper Manhattan. This was a book published about 80 blocks south of YU by the Jewish Theological Seminary. And yeah, Pauline's giving me a look, because it's not often that Orthodox rabbis quote books published by the Jewish Theological Seminary, because the Jewish Theological Seminary is like the bastion of conservative Judaism. But one of my major influences is the thinking of Rabbi Abram Joshua Heschel, who was a longtime teacher at JTS, at Jewish Theological Seminary. And many people know Heschel's book, The Sabbath, his books on philosophy, The Earth is the Lord's, and numerous other books of philosophy, but Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel wrote a book of biblical interpretation. And he wrote it in Hebrew, and it was only translated to English, I think, 40 years after he died. It was a 3-part book that was only published once. And so I remember spending 3 or 4 years trying to find a copy of the original Hebrew I could buy for myself, and it was nowhere. I found like a copy in Jerusalem for, I think it was like 400 shekel for one of the volumes. It's like a lot of money. And I was like a poor smicha student, so I was not paying $100+ for 1/3 of a book. But anyways, a few years after that, it was translated into English with an excellent commentary. So the original book, and it's worth talking about the name of it because it's a beautiful name, is Torah Min HaShemayim Ba'aspaklaria Shel HaDorot. That's the original name. It's a long name. Heschel was often a very verbose writer. I think it translates into the names of his books sometimes too. That means Torah Min HaShemayim, Torah from heaven, through the prism of the generations, or through the viewing lens of the generations. Maybe you'd say the mirror of the generations. And what Heschel's major thesis was in that book is that just as there is a major machlok at 2 schools of thought about how to decide Jewish law, 2 basic approaches to deciding Jewish law, there's also two basic approaches about how to interpret the words of the Torah. So the Torah is from Hashem. The Torah is from heaven. How do we interpret the Torah? Well, there's different lenses, right? Different interpretive tools for how to understand, read, and interpret the Chumash, the Torah that Hashem gave us, and later books as well. If you wanted to understand what this machloket is, and that's why the name of this class is Written by God, but Read by Man, right? When human beings have to read a divine text, right? Like any form of reading, it's our own. We actually bring ourselves into the text, right? When we read Torah, we make ourselves part of the Torah, and our own interpretations, right, add to the beauty of that Torah and to the depth of that Torah. But there's really 2 schools of how to do that. And if you understand these 2 basic schools of Jewish thought, you start to understand centuries and, if anything, millennia of Jewish philosophy that fall really into these 2 schools. And you start to understand contemporary debates about how to live a Jewish life in the prism of those 2 original schools. So that's what I wanted to explore for ourselves tonight.
I just lost the launch, but why are we talking about 2 schools? We have Torah from the divine, and we grant that we are not divine, but you made that point at a lecture several years ago.
Yeah.
We are not infinite, we are finite. So, you know.
And God gave us this perfect, infinite Torah, and commanded us to study it with our finite, imperfect brains. And we have 2 different opinions about the methodology for how to study it.
Okay.
So that's what we're going to explore tonight. So let me introduce our 2 main characters tonight, our 2 basically protagonists, or maybe they're antagonists of each other. These are study partners, Chavrutot, and also Bali Machloket. They were also at odds with each other for many different issues. And their names were Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Ishmael. They both were born right around the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. I put the approximate dates of their birth and death. So if you look at the dates, Rabbi Akiva was born in 50 CE, which places him as a young man in 70 when the temple was destroyed. Right. And Rabbi Ishmael, on the other hand, was born presumably about 20 years after the destruction of the temple, right? And what years did they die?
Both, apparently 135.
Right, in 135 CE. In our tradition, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael are 2 of the 10 martyrs that were killed during the Hadrianic decrees and the Hadrianic persecutions. Let's first talk about their death. Their death was part of the Hadrianic persecutions that were caused in part by the Bar Kokhba revolts, right? So about 60 or so years after the destruction of the temple, there's 1 final uprising by the Jews in Israel, Palestine, really, back then. And they try to overrule the Romans, or they try to overcome the Romans. We know famously that ends with some of the worst, bloodiest episodes in Jewish history. The more famous one today is Masada. Masada probably happened during that time. But in the world of the Talmud, the most extreme version of that was the destruction of a city called Beitar, where according to the Talmud, I think 600,000, maybe even 6 million people were killed. It's unclear. 400,000 or 4 million. Unclear if that's hyperbole or if that's literal, but the Talmud describes like seas of blood being pouring out from the city of Beitar when the Romans crushed it as part of the crushing of the Bar Kokhba revolt. So they also crushed the figureheads of rabbinic Judaism. And so we have a tradition that there were 10 martyrs, Asara Haruge Malchut, the 10 martyrs who were killed as part of these decrees. And so Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva, even though they were at odds with each other in life, their lives ended at the same time because of the same reason, because they both taught Torah in public when Hadrian said that that was forbidden and tried to both demolish the Jewish autonomy, but also the Jewish spirit through the Jewish spirituality. So that's the end of their lives. But we're going to learn more today about their lives themselves and where they came from. And it's impossible to imagine Rabbi Akiva's life without imagining what it must have been like to live through and after the destruction of the temple, right? You can imagine how that's such a profound moment in someone's psyche. I was a child when 9/11 happened. I was basically a middle schooler, giving you a little clue to how old I am now. But that's one of my, even though I'm not American, I'm only Canadian, that's one of my formative moments. I can tell you exactly where I was and remember who was around me and what I saw first hearing the rumors and then seeing it on TV, and then later meeting people whose parents escaped or didn't escape. It's like a formative part of my identity. And you can only imagine for Rabbi Akiva how much the destruction of the temple would have been a formative part of his identity. On the other hand, as far as we can tell, and there's many different accounts about Rabbi Akiva's childhood, Rabbi Akiva was not born into a world of rabbinic elites. Rabbi Akiva was born a pauper. In all likelihood, he did not know how to read or write. And finally, he meets the daughter of a wealthy man whose name was Kalba Savua, and she offers him a proposal of marriage as long as he agrees to study Torah. According to our tradition, he went off for 12 and then another 12 years studying without her, finally came back, was one of the greatest sages, and that's part of his history. So what I want to do today is first understand where these two great Torah giants came from, and then understand how it probably affected their rabbinic personalities, how their backgrounds actually affected who they were and how they studied Torah. And finally, how their interpretations of Torah affected their philosophies of life. Okay, so we're going to kind of do this in three parts. Let's get started by jumping in and reading about Rabbi Akiva. So I'm going to ask you to help me out and do the readings here. I'll turn the microphones around. Kirsten, would you like to start us off by reading the first source? This is an Avot de Rabbi Natan, one of the commentaries we have on Pirkei Avot.
What were Rabbi Akiva's beginnings? It is said, when he was 40 years old, he had not yet studied a thing. One time he stood by the mouth of a well. Who hollowed this stone, he wondered. He was told, it is the water which falls upon it every day continually. It was said to him, Akiva, have you not read the verse, the waters wear away the stones, Job 14:19. Whereupon Rabbi Akiva drew an inference with regard to himself. If that which is soft wears down that which is hard, then all the more so shall words of Torah, which are hard as iron, hollow out my heart, which is flesh and blood. Thereupon he turned to the study of Torah. He went with his son, and they appeared before an elementary teacher. Rabbi Akiva said to him, Master, teach me Torah. Rabbi Akiva took hold of one end of the tablet, and his son took the other end. The teacher wrote Aleph Bet, and he learned it. Aleph Tav, and he learned it. The book of Leviticus, and he learned it. And he continued studying until he learned the whole Torah.
Okay, powerful. Or that kind of commitment, right? It's an important lesson of Rabbi Akiva's life that at 40 years old, you can start something new. And you can, if you're dedicated and you work hard, you can even maybe accomplish the same kind of mastery that Rabbi Akiva did. That's one of really the role models of our tradition. Parenthetically, Rabbi Akiva has a lot to do with Pesach. A lot of the drashot, a lot of the interpretations of the Haggadah itself were taught at the home of Rabbi Akiva, who was living in, not in Yavne, but in
when they were studying at night?
Yeah, that's at the home. In B'nai Brak, thank you. B'nai Brak was Rabbi Akiva's home.
So they're both in that section of the Haggadah.
I think they both are, and they're both sitting at the same table, right? Which is really interesting. So I want to focus on a few things here. First of all, is the order of study, right? It's clear that you start with the alphabet, and then Sefer Vayikra, or the Book of Leviticus, which here is called Torah Kohanim. That's the rabbinic name, the Torah of the priests, because most of Leviticus deals with the priesthood and with the worship in the temple. Why Vayikra? If I were choosing nowadays what the first thing to study would be, that might be like on the list of the last things to teach someone. But in the times of the Talmud, that was actually the first thing that a child would study after they learned the alphabet.
Is that because most of the students were like sons of priests and so they needed to learn?
That's interesting. Maybe. I don't have a good reason for why. I've heard of reasons before, but I think that's a really interesting one. Yeah, Chester.
The theory is, and just the theory is, perhaps the vocabulary is more limited. A lot of nouns referring to priestly. For example, you know, shlamim, the word shlamim probably appears like 50 times.
Yeah, and it's more technical, right? It's a little bit.
Just a thought.
Well, there's an interesting point there. When people would study the Torah, they would actually learn to sing it, and they would memorize it verse after verse. So maybe it's easier to memorize those verses because they're repetitive. Interesting. Akiva.
Two things that I can think of. One is the Korbanot. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, that was the center of Jewish life. The Korbanot. You know, what were they? Why did you bring them? When did you bring them? All of that's in Vayikra.
Yeah.
And then also the laws of Tameh and Tahor.
Right.
You know, because, I mean, all of the rabbis, all of Chazal, were very concerned about what was Tameh and what was Tahor. And it wasn't just, you know, in terms of family purity or anything, but it went way beyond that. It went to, you know, your vegetable garden on your roof, you know?
Yeah. Right. So all of those pieces were fundamental to Jewish life then in a way that it's hard to even imagine now, that really affected the basic parts of our lives. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then it basically says he kind of is given a push, he's given a head start by this teacher, right? He learns the alphabet, he learns Vayikra, and all of a sudden he basically learns the rest. Sounds like almost on his own. The one thing I want to point out that's not super clear in the English that the Hebrew does a much better job at is that when he's told by this person on the side of the road, wherever, right, did you not know that this thing you observed, right, which is that water carved stone, did you not know that that was a verse in Sefer Iyov in the Book of Job? As in, didn't you know that was part of our tradition? And first of all, it's an interesting idea because maybe that sparks in him this desire to study our tradition, right, and to realize that there is more in the Torah than just folk wisdom, that there's more that maybe I can learn from there. But the language in the Hebrew of this Avot Rabbi Natan is Miyad Haya Rabbi Kiva Dan Kal V'Chomer Batzmo. He immediately created an afiorti argument. Kal V'Chomer is one of the main principles of Talmudic study. It's basically, if something is true for A, which is a milder case, then all the more so it'll be B, which is a more stringent case. Right? As in, if you have a stringency about A, which is less strict, then all the more so you would apply that stringency for B, which is more strict. What's interesting here is that Rabbi Akiva had zero basis in formal education, but he clearly had a very sharp sense of logic. Right? And so I think that's an important piece here. And he starts to use that logic to teach himself more and more and more. The next piece in Avot Rabbi Natan that I wanted to quote for today is that he goes before Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua. Right? I think those are also two of the sages who sat with him in B'nai Brak. I could be wrong. Pauline, do you want to read the next piece for us? Oh, sorry. Skipped Kathy. My bad.
I'm not here. I'm in Arizona.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to Pauline. Don't worry, Pauline. I won't forget you. Yeah.
He went and sat before Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. He said to them, "My masters, teach me the meaning of the Mishnah." When they told him one law, he went off and sat by himself. He said, "This Aleph, why is it written? That bet, why is it written? That thing, why was it said?" He came back and asked them, and he reduced them to silence. Rabbi Shimon ben Eliezer says, "I will tell you a parable. To what may this be compared? To a stonemason who was hacking away at the mountains. One time he took up his pickaxe and went and sat on a mountain and began to chop tiny pebbles from it. Some men came by and asked him, 'What are you doing?' He said, 'Behold, I am uprooting the mountain and casting it into the Jordan River.' They said to him, 'You cannot uproot the entire mountain.' But he continued hacking away until he hit upon a large rock. He crawled under it, broke it loose, and uprooted it, and cast it into the Jordan. He said to it, 'That was not your place, but this is.' This is what Rabbi Akiva did to Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua."
Okay. So first of all, if you need a parable to describe someone's life, right, what is that indicative of, right? This person might be larger than life, right? And that's really what we get as a sense of Rabbi Akiva's personality, right? He basically starts from an early stage stumping his teachers, right? Because what are the teachers doing? The teachers are saying, here's a Mishnah. What was a Mishnah back in the day? A Mishnah was a teaching of law that was repeated teacher to student, was passed on orally. And traditionally also, by the way, Mishnah normally didn't have textual proofs from the Torah, right? Mishnahs were generally just the laws without the elucidation of where they came from. What does Rabbi Akiva start doing? He's saying, what verse did it come from? There's an extra aleph in that pasuk. Why is the aleph there? There's an extra bet. There's an extra word davar, right? What's that doing there? And he starts taking these little building blocks of the Hebrew language and expounding upon each tiny detail of it, right? What is this compared to? Rabbi Akiva is a mover of mountains, right? What does that mean? His teachers, right, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, they were the teachers who relied on tradition. They said, this is the Mishnah that was given to us. We're passing this Mishnah on to you. Accept it. It is what it is. This is the mountain. It's over there. And what does Rabbi Akiva do? He says, you know what? I want to interpret this. I want to see what's underneath it. I want to hack away. I want to cut up the mountain to the point where I can throw it in the Jordan River. Rabbi Akiva, in his exegetics, from an early, early stage, is a precise, and not a precise, an imaginative interpreter. Right? Rabbi Akiva is a mover of mountains. Right? Things that used to be what they were, now Rabbi Akiva can cut them apart, can throw them over into the Jordan River. Right? That's very powerful language about the interpretive style of Rabbi Akiva. And what's interesting is that it's not just something he develops later in his learning. This is kind of how he learns from the very beginning. Most people, when they learn the first piece of Torah ever, are not taking it apart with a Kal V'Chomer, with a principle of Talmudic logic. Right? This first story, though, we know about Rabbi Akiva's learning, he's already trying to figure out the logical principles behind the Torah that he was taught. But Rabbi Akiva is this amazingly creative thinker. If you wanted to apply a word to Rabbi Akiva's interpretation, it's creativity. Probably it's a sense of openness in the text. It's what the favorite word I have, Dr. Yaakov Ellman had this term for how to interpret Nachmanides, general style of Torah interpretation. And the word that he used, and by the way, if I don't make this connection clear later, remind me, because Nachmanides is a famous Kabbalist. Nachmanides' approach to Torah study, Dr. Yaakov Ellman calls it omni-significance, that every little word of Torah has numerous layers of meaning to it, right? And you can peel back the layers of meaning. That's what Rabbi Akiva starts to do from the beginning of his Torah study. There's an aleph here. Is that aleph necessary? Is that aleph not necessary? What's the aleph in that verse coming to teach me that I would not have known otherwise? Let's dig deeper and deeper and deeper, right? Let's uproot the mountains of Torah and find out what's underneath them. That's Rabbi Akiva in a nutshell. Putting that in context, we'll see a famous story about him later. But now let's contrast the background of Rabbi Akiva with the background of Rabbi Ishmael. So we're now going to study source 2. This is the Gemara in Gittin 58a. And just to give a little bit of background, as far as we know, Rabbi Did I say Rabbi Yeshua? I meant Rabbi Ishmael. Yeah. Rabbi Ishmael, as far as we know, was born in a very different background to Rabbi Akiva. He was born in a wealthy home, likely in a rabbinic home. He was probably taught Torah from a young age. It wasn't something foreign to him. But he had a trauma early in his life. We know that a lot of the Jews living in Israel were basically subjects of the Romans. And it was not uncommon for them to be taken away to Rome, to be thrown into slavery at a moment's notice. And something like this happens to Rabbi Ishmael. The Gemara after this continues to say that something like this happened to Rabbi Ishmael's kids as well. So he was probably born into an elite society, but lived a very tumultuous, traumatic life. So just kind of keep that in the back of your heads. And let's see what the Gemara in Gittin has to tell us about the life of Rabbi Ishmael. So, Pauline, would you read this for us?
Yes. There was an incident involving Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hanania, who once went to the great city of Rome, where they said to him, "There is a child in prison with beautiful eyes and an attractive appearance, and his curly hair is arranged in locks." Rabbi Yehoshua went and stood by the entrance to the prison. He said, as if speaking to himself, "Who gave Jacob for a spoil and Israel to the robbers?" That child answered by reciting the continuation of the verse, "Did not the Lord, he against whom we have sinned, and whose ways they did not walk, neither were they obedient to his law?" Rabbi Yehoshua said, "I am certain that, if given the opportunity, this child will issue halachic rulings in Israel, as he is already exceedingly wise." He said, "I take an oath by the temple service that I will not move from here until I ransom him for whatever sum of money they set for him." They said that he did not move from there until he ransomed him for a great sum of money. And not even a few days had passed when this child then issued halachic rulings in Israel. And who was this child? This was Rabbi Ishmael ben Elisha.
Okay.
Is that the same Rabbi Yehoshua that we were just talking about?
I don't think so, okay. But I could be wrong. Okay, so what do we see here? Different kind of personality, right? I think it's interesting that Rabbi Akiva's introduction to Torah, or our introduction to Rabbi Akiva that we saw earlier, comes from him not knowing a verse of Torah, right? And then he's taught a verse and he wants more and he wants more and he wants more. Our introduction to Rabbi Yeshua... Thank you, Rabbi Ishmael. I should know the person I'm talking about. Our introduction to Rabbi Ishmael is he's quoted a verse, he's able to finish the verse, right? It's a different kind of intelligence, right? It's the intelligence of someone who retains information, right? Who remembers what he was taught in his youth, even when he's in prison later, right?
But he's still a kid.
Right, so from earlier in his youth. I don't know the importance of his description other than it might be a sign of kind of his... regal upbringing, like the locks in his hair kind of description, I think is almost a description of someone who was raised in a noble place. So you see that, but then he's brought down. Right? So it's almost like opposite stories, right? Rabbi Akiva is a pauper who marries into royalty, right? Rabbi Yeshua is almost like royalty who's brought down to being a slave, brought down to being a servant in Rome. So they almost have these like opposite childhoods. Or not childhoods, opposite origin stories or beginnings, and opposite types of intelligence in the earlier sources we have about them. Mimi and then Steve, yeah.
I just want to know why Rabbi Ishmael, why is that name not used anymore in the Jewish community?
Yeah. That's a great question.
I have a lot of Latino students who are named Ismael and Israel.
Yeah.
Martinez, Gonzalez, you name it.
Yeah.
But they don't have the same kind of distaste for the name Ishmael.
Right.
As I feel it when I hear it.
Right.
Why is that? Because obviously there was a rabbi of great fame.
Yeah.
And to lose that name is interesting.
That's a great question. I assume it has to do with historical circumstances. Right, like there was. I'm wondering if in the golden age of Spanish Jewry, there were probably more Ishmaels back then, but I could be wrong. So I'm guessing it has something to do with our historical encounters with our cousins. But I don't know. It's a great question. If anyone else has an idea. Yes.
I don't have an answer.
Yeah.
We name our boys Shmuel.
Which is a different
close.
Name.
It's a
but it's a different name in the Bible, though, right?
Shmuel is God will hear.
And it has an ayin in it, that Shmuel is just with an aleph. So there, Yishmael is like God has heard, or God will hear.
Right.
And Shmuel is, I don't know what the root.
Hear God.
Shamel, I think, there is God, or here is God. Yeah.
But there is no, we don't name our boys Yishmael.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm sure someone has written about this. Maybe Rabbi Google has something to say about it. Okay. Yeah, thank you, Mimi. Yeah, Steve.
So if you just summarize, Akiva is the intuitive intellect. Yishmael is the literal intellect.
Great. Keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Rabbi Akiva, I'd say there's intuition. There's also a creativity, right? He's a creative intellect. He's willing to come up with his own approaches to things. Right. On the other hand, Rabbi Yishmael is, how did you describe him as?
Literal.
A literal intellect, absolutely.
Literal.
We're gonna hone in on that very, very much so. Okay. Then now that we've seen a little bit about their backgrounds, right, and they're coming from different places and we already see different intellectual personalities, let's see how this actually makes its way into their Torah commentaries. So I'm gonna paraphrase a Gemara Menachot. This is a Gemara that you likely have heard before. And it's a Gemara that's quoted by Rashi at the end when God tells Moses, you're not going to enter the land of Israel, but stand on the top of the mountain. I will show you what will be of the land, right? I think Rashi quotes that this Gemara. And he says, what did God show him? Rashi quotes the Gemara that says that he brings Moshe up into heaven and shows him what's going to be at the end of days. Basically takes him to like all the major events in Jewish history. And one of their, I always think of it as, you know the moment in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory where they jump into the elevator and the elevator kind of shoots out from the top of the factory? I think I'm losing some people, but I have Mimi and Chester here, right? And then they go on this kind of magical ride around London or wherever. So it's almost the way I think of this story is like this magical ride around Jewish history, right? Where God and Moses pop into these various events. And one of the places they find themselves is in the study hall of Rabbi Akiva. In the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Akiva, okay. Why does this come up? Because according to the Gemara Menachot, Moshe when he goes up to heaven first sees God tying crowns, what we call katarim, to some of the letters. In Hebrew, the letters Mansapach, that's an acronym for Mem, Nun, Tzadi, Pei, and Chaf, if I'm not mistaken, have crowns on top of them when they're written in the Torah scroll. They have these special crowns. You don't really see them in contemporary Hebrew. And according to the Gemara, Moshe asks God, God, what are these crowns about? Why do you need these crowns? Generally speaking, when we study Torah, we don't start to say, look at how this letter has a crown and that means this. We don't normally interpret those crowns, right? We don't really know what they're there other than Hashem put them there. And that's what we believe. But Moshe is not everyone, right? So Moshe deserves an answer. And so what does God do? God says that there is going to be this man coming in the future, Akiva, the son of Yosef. And the language here in the Hebrew is powerful. Atid lidrosh et al kol kotz v'kotz. In the future, one day in the future, Moshe, he will expound every single kotz. That's not even the crowns. A kotz is the top of a letter. If you look at Safrut, if you look at Hebrew scribes, they start a letter always at the top. And then they just round it out from the very top. So you have like a little, you almost have like a little bulge at the top. So that's what the kotz is. It's like this tiny kind of piece. And Rabbi Akiva in the future will interpret every one of those kotzim. Tilin, tilin shel halachot. He will take mounds and mounds, almost like mountains and mountains of laws will come out of those little kotzim, those little kotzim. And Moshe says, God, I want to see this for myself. Right. So God takes him to the Beit Midrash. They sit at the back, which is interesting. They sit eight rows back. Just think that's like an interesting thing that Gemara threw in there, right? It's like Moshe is like humble. He's like on the, we know historically that people in the front were always the brightest students.
Mm-hmm.
And the further, we know this from the Sanhedrin, the further back you are, the more junior you were. So here God and Moshe are sitting in the back of class, right? Probably exchanging notes. And here's the point. Not only are they sitting in the back, Moshe had no idea what's going on in class. And it says, Tashash Koho, his power got weakened, right? And when they got to the word, they got to a certain matter that Rabbi Akiva is teaching, and he's teaching these laws, and the students say, Rebbe, as in Rabbi Akiva, where did you get this from? Right? And Rabbi Akiva answers, this is a law that was passed down from Moses at Mount Sinai. Halacha la Moshe Misinai. And Moshe hears this, and he immediately feels better. So Moshe has no idea the derivation of the law, but when he hears that it comes from one of the crowns that he wrote on the first Sefer Torah that God told him to write down, he feels like, oh, I may not understand how that was interpreted, but at least it's from my, at least it came through me. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it was there to teach. It took generations for Rabbi Akiva to expound its meaning, but at least it came through me because I wrote the first crowns down. And then it goes a step further. Moshe says, God, like, look at this Rabbi Akiva. Like, he's the chacham, right? He's the smart one in the room here. Why don't you choose him to give the Torah? And God's response is, shtok, be quiet. Right, that's the nice way to put it. Kach alav machshava lefanai. This is the thought that came up before me. This is what I chose. Don't ask any more questions. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Rabbi Akiva, talking about creativity, maybe intuition, Rabbi Akiva expounded things that no one before him knew to expound. Right. It's not only that he came up with new ideas and new halachot, right? But even the interpretation tools that he had, no one knew of them before. Right, that's Rabbi Akiva's, I'd say, genius of creativity, right, that didn't exist before. Now, let's contrast this with Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Shmuel's no slouch, right? He's not a lazy student. He put in his time, put in his 10,000 hours, right, probably more than that. Right? He got his learning in. But Rabbi Shmuel, we know as a thinker, was a far more methodological interpreter. We see this in halacha. The first thing in the morning that we're supposed to say, and I'm often late to shul, so I skip this, which is not a good thing. But if you listen to Jeff first thing in the morning, it says page 52, Rabbi Shmuel. Right? And so if you were to open Rabbi page 52, I encourage you to do it in your sidurim later, you'll see that there's a braita that we read. It's actually it's a midrash from the Sifra. That there are shloshes remidot shatar nidreshet bahen. Rabbi Shmuel taught us the 13 exegetic principles that law should be used to elucidate the halacha from the Torah. And 13 is not a small number, right? But they're very specific principles, and they can only be used in very specific ways. Right? Rabbi Shmuel had a fixed number of rules for how to do drash, for how to do halachic exegetics, right? Rabbi Akiva, everything is fair game, right? Rabbi Shmuel, you got to learn the rules. You have to learn the traditions of how to apply them. Only then can you get into the business of expounding on the Torah to create law or to interpret law, right? It's almost like, I would almost describe it like Rabbi Akiva is the artist and Rabbi Shmuel is the mathematician, right? In terms of how they interpret the Torah and how they interpret halacha. And we know that they talked about this. They had conversations about this. If you look at source 5 in Chagiga, 12a, Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva are walking on a journey, and he tells him, Rabbi Shmuel tells Rabbi Akiva, you know, you were a student of Nachum Ish Gamzu, fascinating figure in his own right. Nachum Ish Gamzu is the person who drew a circle around himself and said, God, I'm not moving until it rains. That's Nachum Ish Gamzu. Could talk about him for a few classes in his own right. But you were there with him for 22 years. 22 years, right? And you learned an interpretation from him, which is what? Every time the word et comes up in the Torah, you can expound on that word et. So therefore, they got into a debate. The first verse in the Torah is Bereshit bara Elokim, et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. In the beginning, God created et, whatever that means, the heavens, and et, whatever that means, the earth.
Does it mean the?
So what does et mean? Right? It doesn't mean the, because in Hebrew the pronoun of hey.
No, it's a marker of action, right?
Great. So we don't have there is no precise translation in the English language for the word et, It doesn't really exist. The in Hebrew is the hey as a pronoun, as a pronoun. Ha, yeah, exactly. Et is often, in grammatically, it creates a definitive article, if I'm not mistaken. It places emphasis on the word that's going to follow afterwards. But it doesn't normally have a specific meaning to it. And Rabbi Akiva learned this tradition that Rabbi Shmuel really doesn't like, which is that every time he sees the word et, he assumes that it wasn't necessary to be in the Torah, and therefore, each time you see the word et, you can expound a halachic outcome from it. And or you can expound some kind of interpretive outcome from it. And so they get into this debate, like, why do you need to expound the words et? We'll have to get back to how Rabbi Shmuel will read this. And Rabbi Akiva says, oh, you know what it is? It's to teach you that this heaven and earth are not their own gods. And it's to say, in the beginning, God created the thing from God, heaven, and the thing from God, earth. But each et, everywhere in the Torah, has its own unique meaning that can be expounded from the word. Okay. Pretty intense, right? There are thousands of ets in the Torah. And I can guarantee you that the Gemara, you can study the entire Talmud and every Midrash, and you will not find an interpretation of each et in the Torah. But according to Rabbi Akiva, there was one. So what does Rabbi Shmuel do with that? Does Rabbi if you don't interpret them, then how do you explain them? How do you explain their presence? Why did God put et Hashemayim and et Haaretz if they don't have any interpretive meaning? And Rabbi Shmuel's answer, source 6, it's probably the shortest source you're ever going to find me quote. This is the major principle in the name of Rabbi Ishmael, that the Torah speaks in the language of human beings. Dibra Torah Kilshon Bnei Adam. God wrote the Torah in a way that people could understand. So what? Why do you have Et HaShemayim V'Et HaAretz? Why do you have these definitive article Ets? Because that's human grammar. It's just the way that normal people talk.
Yeah.
Right?
Kind of like between people.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Right? You don't need a reason for it. You don't need to expound it. It's a rule of grammar. Human beings use grammar. Therefore, God included the grammar of human beings in the Torah that God wrote, because God wrote the Torah for us in the language that we could understand. Right? So Rabbi Shmuel's response to Rabbi Akiva is, like, don't dray a cup with all of your interpretations. Don't drive us all crazy, right? Sometimes the Torah says what the Torah says just because it says it,
yeah.
Right? He is a, to Steve's original point, a literalist, right? Not every single crown of a Torah letter, not every coats, not every top of a letter needs to have an interpretation, right? God speaks in human terms. Just read the thing the way it was written, right? You don't...
You're talking about definite articles.
What did I say? Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, so if that's very interesting, because in Spanish, you can avoid them. And it's still, their meaning is the same.
In Hebrew, you can avoid them too. Yeah, you don't need an et to really understand it.
Just say
ha. Right, you could just say, Bereshit bara Elokim, ha-shamayim ve-ha-aretz. It doesn't sound actually normal, because there's this intuitive sense that native speakers of Hebrew use for when they use the word et and when they don't. But you would understand that verse perfectly well without the et in that verse.
Mm-hmm.
Unless if you're like Rabbi Akiva, who needs to find some interpretive meaning in each et. Right? Rabbi Shmuel is... Right, for some of our personalities, Rabbi Shmuel makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right? By the way, we talked about different readers or interpreters of the Constitution, right? Literalists, right? And then, I don't know if creative... I don't know what the right word is, but people who try to think, what was the intention of the framers of the Constitution when they put that word in, right? That's kind of Rabbi Akiva's style of interpretation. Yeah, Steve.
It seems to me that Rabbi Ishmael is going further.
Yeah, how so?
He's not seeing the Torah as infinite, that can only be understood by us finite. To him, the Torah is not infinite, but the implication is the Torah is simply that finite document written, not the interface between an infinite existence and us finite beings. That's what's, to me, being implied.
I think it's more nuanced. I think it's more nuanced, and I want to get back to that point with how they interpret. I think they both agree. Here's how I would suggest it, and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel brings Midrashim from both schools. We'll get to this in a few minutes. There are actually different collections of Midrashim from each school. they ended up writing their own books based on what school you were in. There's a Mechilta de Rabbi Shmuel. There's a Mechilta Midrash in the school of Rabbi Shmuel. And there's a separate Mechilta in the students of Rabbi Akiva. It's often referred to as the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rabbi Shimon the son of Yochai, which is an important name, and we'll get to that later also. An example of this is on the nature of receiving the Torah from heaven, right? What is Torah Min HaShemayim? What is Torah from heaven? Right, so for Rabbi Shmuel, Torah is a document that God wrote and gave to people, right? And its core, it's a human document, or it's a divine document written for people, right? And it should be interpreted the way that people interpret documents, right? For Rabbi Akiva, right, God lives in that document, right? This is, by the way, we're going to get into this, the mystical approach, right? Where God looked into the Torah to create the world, right? The Torah is more than just a series of letters that make up words, that make up verses, that make up laws. Right, for Rabbi Akiva, the Torah is a spiritual, metaphysical blueprint of everything in existence. And so you can dig under and under and under and find more and more and more to it. It's not a human document. I think there's something there. Okay, let's see how this affects... I actually really want to read this quote from Rabbi Shasha Heschel because I think he summarizes this better than I could. So I'm going to read this quote in Source 7, and then we'll go on into more forms of interpretation. Okay, this is from the book that I quoted earlier. Rabbi Akiva could be credited with seeking out the wondrous. Rabbi Shmuel could be credited with shunning the wondrous. He shook no structural beams, nor did he impose his authority on the text. Among his good qualities was a level-headed caution. Better in his eyes was a single measure of reflection on what is written and given than massive speculation above and beyond the very limits of apprehension. One who sees Rabbi Shmuel in a dream should, quote, anticipate wisdom. I think that's a Gemara in Brachot, that it starts giving interpretations of dreams. So if you see Rabbi Shmuel, you should anticipate wisdom. Rabbi Shmuel's teachings contain straightforward logic, and with it lucidity, simplicity of language, and an aversion to intellectual games. Attributions to him have no superfluity of language or florid expressions. He sought to strip scripture of anthropomorphisms. That's going to be important. We'll get to that later. And to excise unnecessary metaphor and imagery. Okay. But Rabbi Akiva's teachings sought to penetrate to inner depths with profundity and potency of language. He did not shrink from anthropomorphism, but rather he preserved the concrete in scripture, cherished imaginative meanings, added metaphorical embellishments, and created images of the supernal world. What does Rabbi Akiva sound like? Sounds like a Kabbalist, right?
So there is a tradition that Rabbi Akiva went to the garden.
Okay.
And came back, and he came back whole.
Great.
But did Rabbi Ishmael, was he part of the four that went to the garden in that particular? I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I think those were the students of Rabbi Akiva. Because we, according to our tradition, Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students, right? And they all died during... because of Sinat Chinam, because of hatred for each other. Many, there are the historians who think that maybe those were the Bar Kokhba revolters, maybe. I think that's an interesting idea. I don't know if it's provable.
Isn't there a plague?
But then, that's what the Talmud says. But there are those who think that it might have been the students of Bar Kokhba. In any case, they all die out, and then he has four or five more primary students. If I'm not mistaken, those are the ones who go up with him. So that idea of Rabbi Akiva going up to the pardes, going up to the orchard, whatever that is, right? So we have two different interpretations. One is pardes stands for the four levels of Torah biblical interpretation, right? Pshat, remez, drash, sod. Simple meaning, hints in the text, exposition, and secrets of the text. Rabbi Akiva is the one who can go up into that orchard, expound all the various levels of secrecy in the text, and come back down to earth. That's one interpretation. The mystical interpretation that you see in the earliest of Kabbalistic literature, like the Heichalot, the books of the chambers, that describe these ascents to heaven through different chambers and different elements of God, primarily the people you see in those books of early Kabbalistic literature are Rabbi Akiva and his students. Kabbalah comes from the world of Rabbi Akiva, Jewish mysticism, who, according to the mystical tradition, is the author of the Zohar. Historically, this is questionable, but in the Zohar, the Book of Splendor, which is one of the primary Kabbalistic texts, is written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, not coincidentally, one of the primary, if not the primary, students of Rabbi Akiva. right? Mysticism emerges from the school and the world and the imaginative elements of Rabbi Akiva's interpretation, right? That's really important. By the way, I don't think it's an extreme extension to say that who is the ideological godfather of Maimonides, right? Yes. The rationalist of our tradition?
Yes,
Rabbi Ishmael, yeah. Right? So it's important here, right? The debates between the early the Kabbalists and the rationalists of the 10, 11, 12th centuries, right? Those are really debates that were happening 1,000 years earlier in the study halls of Israel in the times of the Mishnah, right? Now, I remember this French expression, la plus ça change, la plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more they're the same, right? Jewish history is just a series of repetitions and developments along similar lines. You could trace current day, right, Jewish philosophers and say, is this person more influenced by Rabbi Akiva or is this person more influenced by Rabbi Ishmael? Right? This is a profound debate, not only in the nature of how to interpret the Torah and how to think of Judaism as a whole, but also in the major history that was created of these two schools. So let's just...
Also in Shulchan Aruch
alone. How so in the Shulchan Aruch?
Rabbi Yosef Cairo was a Kabbalist.
Right. Rabbi Moshe Israelism may have been a Kabbalist too. Yeah. But yes, Kabbalah has had no lack of impact on the Jewish world.
Yeah.
Rabbi Dean Steinsaltz says that Jewish mysticism has won the 1,000-year-long debate to be the functioning theology of Judaism. I think that's his language. It's a great expression, right? Like, but, right, Rambam stands strong for a lot of Jews out there. There are a lot of Jews who would not be Jewish if it weren't for the rationalism of Maimonides and Rav Sadia Gaon, and even to some extreme, right, Gershonides, the Ralbag, who took some extreme philosophical positions, and they root themselves, right, in the thinking of, right, Rabbi Ishmael. Right? If you see a biblical commentary like the Ibn Ezra, who's very much about, like, let's just understand the grammar, understand the meaning of the words, put them together, that's what the text is telling you. Right? That's a very Rabbi Ishmael approach to Torah study. That's the Ibn Ezra, as opposed to Nachmanides, Ramban,
mm-hmm.
right, who's saying, what's the secret, what's the sode
well,
behind
where does
this
Rashi
text?
Fall in all that?
Somewhere towards the middle of the spectrum.
Yeah.
But he's not, yeah, there's more there. Okay, so you want to know we're short on time, and so if you want to know the biggest machloket, the biggest practical debate between these two schools in terms of how people live their lives, it was about how to prioritize Torah study over work. Okay, right. Let's think of Rabbi Akiva's primary students, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. What's the quintessential story, or the foundational story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? That Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was teaching Torah in public, and the Romans put out the word, right, we want his neck. So what does he do? He goes, he hides in a cave, right, with his son, and what do? They cover themselves up with sand, they study Torah all day long, and miraculously, miracles, by the way, much more Rabbi Akiva style thing than a Rabbi Ishmael style thing. Rabbi Ishmael generally, if there's a way to interpret a miracle out of the Torah, that's the style of interpretation of Rabbi Ishmael, right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, according to our tradition, hangs out in a cave for 12 years. I think it's 12 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Carob tree miraculously grows, stream miraculously enters, food to eat, water to drink, Torah to study, let's go, have a good time, right? And when he leaves the cave, right, for the first time, what happens to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son? I think it's Rabbi Elazar, right? They see farmers working the land. They get furious that they're not studying Torah. Fire emerges out of their eyes. It's like the original X-Men, right? They burn up the farmers, and God says, you're not ready to go back to your cave. Right? So, right, I don't know if it was 10 more, I think it was one more year maybe. So keep that in mind with this story we're about to see. If you want to read later sources 8 and 9 for yourselves, where you'll see earlier references in the Midrash to the different schools of thought of Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva around work, and work versus Torah study. But then I want to study for now source 10 in the Talmud and Brachot. This is a famous source in the Talmud, and what it's based on is the blessing in the Shema that if you do God's will, v'asafta deganecha, then you'll be able to gather in your grain or your corn. You'll be able to gather in your grain. So the question is, like, why does God really have to promise this to us? Like, Don't I know that God rewards the righteous and punishes the wicked? Right? That might be taken for granted. So I want us to, on source 10, jump down to the second paragraph where it says the sages taught. Mimi, would you like to read this for us?
Which one is it?
It's source 10, Brachot 35b.
Okay.
Yeah.
The sages taught, what is the meaning of what which the verse states? And you shall gather your grain. Because it is stated, this Torah shall not depart from your mouth, and you shall contemplate it in day and night. I might have thought that these matters are to be understood as they are written. One is to literally spend his days immersed exclusively in Torah study. Therefore, the verse states, and you shall gather your grain, your wine, and your oil, assume in the regard the way of the world, set aside time not only for Torah, but also for work. This is a statement of Rabbi Ishmael.
Okay, so how do we balance our lives? Right, this is a philosophical question. But here, like everything, like many things in the Talmud, it's rooted in a textual problem. The textual problem is, like, how do I interpret the words, gather your grain? And the answer, or what we're going to say is, well, you need this verse to counterbalance another verse. The other verse is in Joshua, where it says, Lo yamush sefer Torah zemipicha, that you should never let this Torah book ever leave your mouth. If I only had that verse in Joshua, I may have thought that what's the proper behavior for a human being? Right? Study from morning to night and don't do anything else. Don't let the Torah leave your mouth. Therefore, the Torah also has to give me the verse of V'asafta Teganecha, you should gather in your grain. That's actually a blessing. It's a good thing to work in the fields, to gather in your grain. Right? You should, and therefore Rabbi Ishmael says, what's the ideal of the world? Balance. Right? Sounds like a kind of rational thing to say. Right? We're thinking about his personalities, exegetics. There's two verses. They seem to contradict each other. What's the answer? Both, right? Just 50-50 or some kind of medium between the two. Okay, that's so far Rabbi Ishmael. Chester, do you want to pick us up with a second opinion? Yeah. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the students of Rabbi Akiva.
Yeah, Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai says, is it possible that a person plows in the plowing season and sows in the sowing season? And harvests in the harvest season, and threshes in the threshing season, and winnows in the windy season, as grain is separated from the chaff by means of the wind, and is constantly busy. What will become of Torah? Rather, one must dedicate himself exclusively to Torah at the expense of other endeavors, as when Israel performs God's will, their work is performed by others, as it is stated. And strangers will stand and feed your flocks. And foreigners will be your plowmen and your vine dressers. From Isaiah. When Israel does not perform God's will, their work is performed by them themselves, as it is stated. And you shall gather your grain. Moreover, if Israel fails to perform God's will, others' work will be performed by them. As it is stated, you shall serve your enemy, whom God shall send against you in hunger, in thirst, in nakedness, and in want of all things.
Okay.
Some, should I keep going?
Yeah, but I think there's actually... okay, pause here.
Okay.
That verse in the Shema, V'asafta Deganecha, you should gather your grain. The simple meaning of the Shema is when you listen to God and you fulfill his commandments, what happens? You're rewarded with
right.
the ability of gathering in your harvests.
Right.
What is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai just say? And you have to read it carefully. He says that what is gather your harvests? You thought that was a blessing. That's actually a curse.
Mm-hmm.
He says that's a curse, right?
Because you have to do it. Because
right.
if you were
right.
studying Torah, other people would do your work.
Exactly. If you were studying Torah, you wouldn't have to worry about gathering your grain. Right? Gathering your grain is at best... like, meh, right? It's like, if you're really holy, you wouldn't have to do that either. Is that the simple reading of those verses?
No. This gentleman is the one who's the disciple of Akiva.
Exactly, of Rabbi Akiva, yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is one of the primary disciples of Rabbi Akiva. Also, as we mentioned, he's the rabbi who hangs out in the cave, according to the mystical tradition, he's the author of the Zohar, right? He's the mystic among us, right? And he says, you follow God's will strictly enough. If you're careful enough, if you're punctilious enough, I don't know if I find the right word there, then you will not have to work. There will be metaphysical changes to the order of the universe such that others will do your work for you. Okay, let me just, if it's okay, right? So here you have two different schools of interpretation, right, that lead to two hugely different outcomes about what the ideal state of a Jew's life should look like, right? Rabbi Shmuel, the literalist, right, the rationalist, says, what's the right way for a Jew in the world?
Mm-hmm.
It's to find balance, right? Study Torah and work. And work is a blessing, by the way, right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the students of Rabbi Akiva, right, interprets the Shema totally against its simple reading, right, where a blessing is turned into a curse, right? And as a mystic, or a pre-mystic maybe, right, he says that really God will change the order of the universe for you if you do the will of God. How should you expect yourself to eat if you're studying Torah all day? Miracles. God will find others to act for you, to do your will for you. Interesting how, and you can read this in your own time later, there's actually a debate among the later Amoraim, the rabbis of the Talmud, about who's right. This machloket about what the right way of the world is in terms of Torah versus work, many people think that this is something that was like, this is a contemporary problem, right? If you look at Israeli newspapers, it's constant articles and tensions about the ultra-Orthodox who want to sit and study in Kola all day versus the secular Israelis who say that you're not serving in the army and this is bad, right? We think of this as a new problem, but this problem was happening in the Beit Midrash in the times of the Mishnah, right? La plus ça change, la plus c'est la même chose, right? The more things change, the more they're the same. And even the rabbis of the times of the Amoraim, Abaye says that people tried to live like Rabbi Shmuel and were successful, and they tried to live like Rabbi Akiva or Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and they were not successful. And then Rabbi Bar Hanna says the name of Rabbi Yochanan, that you know what? In the early generations when people were really righteous, the second mystical approach worked out for them. It doesn't work out for us, but that's because we're not righteous. So you actually have debates among the later rabbis about who's right in the earlier rabbis. And it's just continued and continued and continued through today. We've gone late, and I want to just wrap up a few things. A famous midrash. This is source 11. I'm just going to read the end of it in the name of the Sifrei, which is from Rabbi Akiva, or at least according to Rabbi Abram Joshua Heschel, this is taught in the name of Rabbi Akiva. We have this famous verse. This might be the first song we teach many children: Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, Morasha Ki Yaakov. That Torah was commanded to us by Moses as an inheritance from the Kehila, the community of Jacob. Okay, it's something that's passed on generation to generation. Rabbi Akiva famously interpreted the word morasha, right? And this is, by the way, not a simple interpretation. He said, Al tikre morasha, don't read the word as an inheritance. Ella meurasa, rather betrothed. Torah was commanded to us by Moses. It is betrothed to the community of Israel. Meurasa hi leYisrael. It is betrothed to Israel. In the world of Rabbi Akiva and his students, the Torah is like a partner in marriage. It's a relationship, right? It's a human relationship that is about intimacy, right? About closeness, right? The Kabbalists and the rationalists always debated about what the nature of God is. Is God immanent and close, or is God transcendent, right, and all-powerful and unknowable, right? The Kabbalists often primarily focus on immanence and closeness, and the rationalists focus on, right, separation and transcendence, right? This debate goes back to how we think of the Torah, right? Is the Torah just a morasha, just an inheritance that's passed on from generation to generation? That's a simple reading, right? Or is the Torah something, by the way, this interpretation is wild, right? That's not what the word says, right? The word, if God wanted to say Mu'urasa, God would have said Mu'urasa, it's engaged or betrothed to us. But the school of Rabbi Akiva says, reinterpret, find out what's the secret behind that word. And Morasha, a simple inheritance, can actually be a marriage, right? Of intimacy, right? Of imminence, of divine closeness, right? So this debate about how we think of God really has its origins in how we interpret the Torah, right, in the school of Rabbi Akiva versus the school of Rabbi Shmuel. It has major implications on how Jews are expected to live out their lives, right? Uh-huh. Do you dedicate everything, every moment to God, which means Torah study in the world of Rabbi Akiva, and therefore you ignore the physical world, the world of work? Or do you try to find balance, the world of work matched together with the world of Torah? And I'll just add one last thing. It also has to do with messianism, right? It's not coincidental that the primary rabbi who supported the Bar Kokhba revolt was Rabbi Akiva, mm-hmm. right? Rabbi Akiva actually interpreted words of the Torah that there's a verse, I think, in Isaiah, Darach Kochav Miyakov, that a star has come from the tribe of Jacob, from the people of Jacob. And he said, who is that? Bar Kokhba, right? In the Talmud, it's Bar Kuziva, which is the Aramaic of the son of the star. He interpreted the words of our tradition and said, there's a star coming to save us. And who is that? Right? That's Bar Kokhba. Mm-hmm. Right? And Rabbi Akiva is one of the primary figures. We think of him with incredible deference and respect. But he also brought upon one of the major tragedies of Jewish history, right? Which was the decimation of whatever Jews were left 60 years after the destruction of the temple. Because he was willing to read in and to see hope and to see miracles or the possibility of miracles in every moment, because of his creative interpretation and his openness to finding God in every possibility of the Torah, every possible reading of the Torah, every possible interpretation of history, Rabbi Akiva said we should basically go against all rational thought and try to defeat the Roman armies, right, with a small group of Jews led by Bar Kokhba, who himself was not like a very pious figure. Bar Kokhba at best was a troubled figure. He made his soldiers cut off their fingers to prove their allegiance. But Rabbi Akiva was willing to look past that, right, in a desire, right, that but God's right here, right, and Mashiach's coming, and not all hope is lost, right? There's the possibility of miracles, right? That personality, that hopefulness, that creativity, that belief in miracles that comes out of a more imminent experience of God in our lives has risks associated with it. And it's not coincidental, right, that many moments in Judaism where Kabbalah has been strongly emphasized have led to major problems for the Jewish people, right? You can think about Shabbat Tzvi, Sabbatianism, right? Sabbatianism would not have happened without the renaissance of the Kabbalah from Rabbi Isaac Luria and the Arizal, right? And so what's the truth? Of course, we believe in Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, both these and these are the words of the living God. We believe in both the interpretive tools and the rationalist thinking of Rabbi Shmuel, and in the creativity, in the imminence, in the hopefulness of Rabbi Akiva. And I think one of the lessons of Jewish history is that we have to hold on to both. You know, if nothing, this is one of the main reasons why I believe in modern orthodoxy, right? Because I think we can hold on to multiple traditions and multiple truths, right? And deal with the complexities that come between them. Because that keeps us, right, in a straight and narrow path from Rabbi Shmuel, and also lets us hold on to the hopefulness and the creativity and the beauty in the miraculous interpretations of Rabbi Akiva. There's a lot more to think about, but I'll pause here and answer questions. Yeah.
Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the Akiva disciple.
Yeah.
Are the Haredi big on him today in Israel?
I don't think there. The answer is yes, but I don't know. I don't know that would come at the expense of Rabbi Shmuel, and I also don't know that many people, period, know about this idea that there's really two schools of thought.
Because
when you're learning in yeshiva, you basically just you go through sugya after sugya. You don't kind of think. Mm-hmm. You don't think systematically, or in these kinds of categories.
But when this does show up, is actually in Hasidus.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's where you actually see the interplay between these two in a much more dynamic and dramatic way, even.
Yeah.
Is within the Hasidic dynasties and Chabad, very much so even right now today.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say also, like, between the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon.
But that was the whole thing, was that, you know, you've got, they could be Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yeshua.
Right. Yeah, I think it's more complicated than that,
it
right?
Yes, absolutely.
Because, like, if anyone needs to go, please feel free. And I'm happy to keep talking. Now, I'm going to stop the recording for now, and happy to keep talking for a few more minutes. Thanks, everyone, for being here.